Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4, packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
Hey guys, it's Jim Costa from Cash the Ticket. If you're planning on betting college football bowl games, good luck. No, seriously, it's never been harder. And you don't want to be hurting your bankroll. You want to make sure you're doing your homework. Listen to Cash the Ticket. Mike Valeni and I will be breaking down every single bowl game, dropping new episodes nearly every day throughout college football's postseason. Spicing things up with a 12-team playoff. Can't wait to see some of those teams from the South come up north for the snow. Be sure to subscribe to Cash the Ticket on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of Better Living, a show about people or organizations having a big impact here in North Texas. I'm your host, Chris Arnold of 105.3 The Fan. And this morning, our first guest, she's here talking about the holidays. She is the CEO of Seek Foundation, talking about STEM activities that children and families can do together these holiday season. And I'm not going to mispronounce your name. Anike, please help me pronounce your last name.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. My name is Anike Sakariyawo.
Anike Sakariyawo. I will not mispronounce it. I promise you. And thank you again for joining us because, again, there are so many kids who want to do different things over the holidays, and a lot of them don't just want to run outside and play. They want to do things because they grew up with tablets, the whole nine yards. And I know that you've got ideas centered around STEM activities that children and families can do over the holidays. Can you tell us some of those activities? And then we're going to talk about you and all about SEEK.
Sure, absolutely. There are so many activities that students can engage with now that, you know, they have access to technology because, you know, mm-hmm. I didn't have my first cell phone until I was 21. But anyways, that's another story.
Me too.
Then we have something in common. So some of the activities, because they have access to technology, a lot of kids are using Canva to create and design. They can actually create like holiday cards using Canva. And if they don't have any ideas on what their design would be, they can also use the AI generator on Canva. Mm-hmm. And then you also have coding apps that students can do at home or children can do at home. And then there's also making like a snow globe. You can find a jar around the house, get some glue, put a little plant from outside in there with some water and oil. So there are so many activities that you can do at home with your child or students with legal guardians. And if you don't have an idea, you can always go to ChatGPT.
Exactly. Exactly. I'm going to go ahead and just break this down for people who are over the age of 25. They sometimes have a fear of technology. They have a fear of AI in particular, but they have a fear of technology so much so that their kids are tech support. You know what I'm talking about. You know where I'm going with this. It's like, baby, can you change the channel for me? Or baby, can you get that app downloaded for me? And that's what kids do. So kids, they have no fear of technology. It's just another tool. It's just another way for them to be on top of their games, right?
And so kids are also, you know, they're innocent. They're not afraid to make mistakes.
Right.
You know, as you get older, it's like, oh my God, you know, when you're working, you're in your career, you're in the environment, you try to make as minimal mistakes as possible. So technology, it has its pros and its cons, but this is the world that we're living in. And so for children that's teaching their parents or parents asking their children for assistance, it's not that bad. It's not as bad as everybody think it is. And most people have the misconception on the use of technology and AI, but it's not as bad as everyone think it is.
Exactly. You can't be afraid of something that you know about. I always use the example when I talk to my kids about not having fears of things. I say, you know what? You can respect something if you don't know what it is or don't understand it, but you don't automatically just fear it. In other words, there's a worm right there. There's a snake right there. You're not afraid of a worm because you know a worm is a worm and you know a snake is a snake. You can respect the snake, give him his space, be careful around him. But you don't necessarily have to fear things that you don't understand. Am I doing this the right way?
Exactly. And I totally agree. Recently, I just left from a school. We're working with them to do our first AI and engineer fair. Mm-hmm. And while we were leaving, there was a large iguana. And iguanas are like lizard. They're in the lizard yes. family. They look like a Komodo dragon. But and so the staff member, she was so afraid to walk past the iguana. I said, listen, you see the perception is a huge lizard, but it's not going to do anything to you. Just come on and walk by. So the same concept that you're talking about, the fear of just even the perception
right.
on what it may be can, you know, slow people down in regards to interacting with whether it's an animal, technology, a person, or any other noun that you can come up with.
I'm glad you used that example of an iguana because our family, we have a bearded dragon named Flash. And Flash looks just like a little dinosaur, but he won't hurt anybody. So I love the examples you're using. Anike, let's talk about SEEK just for a little bit here. You're an educator, and then you decided to come up with this foundation. In fact, I love it. SEEK is representing Seeking Education Empowers Knowledge. Can you talk about why you came up with the idea for this nonprofit and what you hope to accomplish?
So when I first started the nonprofit, I just thought about the needs that I witnessed with some of the students I worked with as a teacher, whether they did not have a functioning pair of shoes, if their shoes were flapping on the side, mm-hmm. or a book bag, or you know, clean clothes. So I started with providing clothes to students and also feeding and clothing the homeless. And then I transitioned into adding the education piece because I said, you know, I love this, but what is it that I really want to do? If I had to choose something for the rest of my life, it would definitely be an education. And so the nonprofit birthed out of my experience of working with students and also seeing the need, but then there was a greater need when it came to having access to STEM, which stands for science, technology, engineering, mathematics, mm-hmm. programs. And the education piece birthed into SEEK Foundation because I believe that education can take you anywhere in the world. And that's one thing no one can take from you. They can't take what's on the inside of your brain just moving like a machine. And so we now offer programs, after school programs and workshops to children ages 5 through 18. And I get a lot of kickback from that because a lot of people are like, oh, you have to choose a specific age, what age group. But we service kids in cohorts of elementary, middle, and high school because all kids need STEM. And so that's how it kind of birthed. And we work out of different states. Texas, we're looking to launch our new program next year because we've been open there. But it's just been kind of challenging after COVID to get like programs started. So, but that's me going on a tangent. So that's how it kind of birthed.
No, people love this. And again, a lot of people like to do things with nonprofits and a lot of people have ideas to start nonprofits, but just like any small business, you guys are the most courageous people in the world because it takes a lot of nerve, a lot of guts, a lot of faith to start mm-hmm. something from scratch. And again, especially in the nonprofit section, because it's all about people having some empathy on what you're trying to accomplish. And I think what you're doing is in the right direction because SEEK is not just another nonprofit. It's a mobile online nonprofit. And that's, I think, again, that's the wheelhouse for kids nowadays. And you mentioned ages 3 through 18. I mean, and the foundation is education, health, fitness, community involvement. Those are the things that people, it strikes a nerve with them. It makes them more compassionate than something that's just, oh, okay, it's a small business and I might need it or I might not. I think there's the element of helping others that makes people want to do things with you. You found that to be the case?
I do. I mean, and I'm so passionate. Like I tell people all the time, I am going to be the next Oprah Anike, but then mm-hmm. it'll be Anike. Because somebody has to take the torch at some point.
Sure.
But for me, I love helping people because I know that's my purpose, my mission, and also transferring knowledge. And to be able to do that wholeheartedly, of course, through the nonprofit, which is able to help me transfer, whether it's, you know, a family that may need assistance over the holidays, whether it's a parent that want to learn AI on how to do their business or a student that needs to learn about, you know, technology on how to build a robot. So these are examples on why I enjoy what I do. Like, I love it. So, Lord forbid I live a long life, but if something was to happen to me, at least I know I was living my life on purpose.
Yes.
Based on what was embedded for me to do.
Oh, yeah. It's all about having a purpose-driven life. That's what it's all about. I mean, when you pass away on your tombstone, it's not going to say what you did in business. They're going to talk mm-hmm. about the legacy you left behind for your family mm-hmm. and those that care about you. I love talking to you, Anike, because you're like I said, you're a deep person. But I learned through, especially through the pandemic, some of the real heroes are the educators, because mm-hmm. the kids, again, they didn't know how long a pandemic would last. They heard all kinds of information, misinformation, disinformation. They didn't know what to think. And then they got isolated and had to have a lot of virtual learning. So I always looked at educators as someone that could help the kids, you know, not only learn their regular lessons, but learn how to deal in the world that they're in today and not be afraid moving forward. And I'm saying all of this because I'm trying to set you up for this, because I think we're on the same page. You have this part of your program, SEL, Social Emotional Learning. Can you tell us what that means to you? And am I on the right track with it?
Absolutely. And so SEL, Social Emotional Learning, for me is, it's therapy. It's mm-hmm. teaching students how to respond, how to articulate their feelings, mm-hmm. how to find strategies on dealing with their feelings, how to find strategies on dealing with other people in their feelings, how to not personalize what other people are going through. So SEL is all about teaching kids strategies on how to interact in the world with different people, how to deal with their feelings, how to deal with other yes. people, and what strategies are most helpful. Like, you don't have to have a whole bunch of strategies, but you can use one strategy. What is it I need in this moment? What will make me feel better? Do I understand the different emotions that are happening? And so that's why we embedded SEL in our program, because I've seen students, you know, whether, you know, I had a student just, you know, knock a kid down. I'm like, why did this? But they had some other stuff going on. But anyway.
Yeah, yeah. It happens. Yeah, yeah.
It's just to see the different emotions with students mm-hmm. and also the staff on how they react to students based on the emotions that are being exhibited. So for the most part, we definitely put social emotional learning in our program because kids need it. Adults, we need it too, because I tell students all the time, you have adults that still don't know how to react with their emotions. So we're mm-hmm. all human. So it's definitely important when kids are learning those skills at an early age, they can take it and transition into their adult life.
Exactly. I think mental wellness, people are taking it more seriously because of the mm-hmm. pandemic, and found out that, you know, a lot of people were struggling. Some of them because they were isolated, some of them because they didn't have their same habits that they used to do, the work habits or working from home, and they were used to being around people or whatever the different things were. It started weighing on them. And also, you know, with social media, you don't know what to believe, because sometimes you're talking to someone that you think is your friend, and maybe it's not. Maybe it's a bully. Maybe it's a bot. Maybe it's just, you know, something that's just so overwhelming. It's like, oh, and you try to keep that to yourself. So you imagine a kid going through something like that. And that's why I love organizations like yours that are helping reach out to kids in ways that they can not only learn, but they can emotionally grow as well. Can you talk about when you first started the SEEK Foundation, and what was the initial reaction to those that were helping you out and those who were like, oh, you're in over your head?
So I've experienced both. When I first started SEEK, and I'm a visionary. Mm-hmm. I'm a dreamer too. Like mm-hmm. I can dream like I'm going to travel to Mars tomorrow, some type of way. And so going back to starting a nonprofit, I've always had in the back of my mind, I can remember even as a child, I used to do hair, mm-hmm. charge people $35 30 years ago. And so when I got into the nonprofit space, one, I was told, like, I don't think you should do this. It's very challenging. The resources when it comes to being a woman of color. Mm-hmm. But then it was, you know, conversations about, you know, you can do it. Go for it. I see your drive. I see that you're resilient. But the reality of it, it was very challenging. I know I spent numerous times and days using my small teacher salary to purchase items for students. But then I got to a capacity building program when I learned about like building relationships with people, because I've always been a type of person, even though I have a bubbly spirit, but just being in isolation, like I just like to work, get it done. But for the most part, the rewarding piece of being in a nonprofit space is building relationship with people and how you can connect and you're on the same page and vision on what you want to do with children or adults. And then it started to metamorph because it's like, now I can do this. Mm-hmm. I believe in what I'm doing. I believe in it to the depth of me. And so from there, we've been able to build these different relationships, whether it's partnerships with Blackstone, we're working with Miami Rise, that's also partners with Dallas. We work with cohorts of people in Texas throughout mm-hmm. Dallas and Houston. And, you know, we work with Formula One. It's not a lot of people, women of color, that can say they have a partnership with that, with the Miami Dolphins and so forth and so on.
Exactly.
So it has its challenges. And also, as you grow more, the problems increase as well. But again, I love what I do. And it was just more so of me believing in myself, regardless of what anyone says. I was able to, you know, be where I am today. I left teaching. I quit 6 years ago. And I've just been working with the nonprofit full time.
I love what you're saying, because my favorite quote of all time, this is from growing up all the way to this day, is a quote that said, "Some people see things as they are and ask why. I dream things that never were and ask why not." And that's the way I live my life. And so it's kind of like mirroring what you've been doing. And I like the fact that you've been, you know, the journey has been the reward. In other words, there's been twists and turns and ups and downs, but you keep striving. And I love this about you, Anike, and I'm actually looking at some of your accomplishments. So don't let me embarrass you, but I got to say this. 2023 Visionary Award recipient at the Women of Color STEM Digital Twin Experience Conference. Also 2023, the Baya STEM Conference Award winner, celebrating community service and awarding honorees that have shown leadership through outreach both within and outside of work related to STEM. And you've taught a variety of educational courses, workshops, people from all walks of life during, like I said, your 16-year teaching career. So again, the journey has been rewarding. And it's like I said, it's like individuals like you that we pull for. And all you're doing is spreading the message, especially with kids, that STEM can give you a career and not just a job. And it's letting families know, do not be afraid to let your kids learn math and all those different things, engineering. And I mean, I could go on and on and on. Can you talk about like some of your first groups you were working with and how you had to convince them, or how some of the little kids actually gravitated towards you?
Yeah, absolutely. So what my first group of students was actually when I was a science teacher. And I tell people this story all the time, is when I was thrown into a science classroom, because I went to school to teach kids with learning disabilities, because my older sister was autistic. Mm-hmm. And so she inspired me because I taught her how to write PAT. And so once I started teaching students and I was thrown into this sixth grade middle school classroom, I'm like, Lord, what you want me to do here? I don't know about it. I'm like, okay, let me figure this out. So working with a group of kids in sixth grade.
Yeah, that's that age where they want to question everything.
When I say middle school kids, oh my God.
Yeah,
but handful. Anyways.
They're a handful.
I felt intimidated by the subject. And I said to myself, now I gotta be smarter than the sixth grader. I know they say fifth grade, but I need to be smarter than the sixth grader. And so I actually started taking courses at a community college, mm-hmm. and I started implementing like music with the kids and learning the vocabulary, like teaching myself to how to internalize the information, and also how can I transfer it to other people. So that was my first experience teaching sixth grade science. And then with the nonprofit, my first experience working with the nonprofit was teaching at Breakthrough Miami. I taught a cohort of girls at the time, And it was me trying to experiment on different things than STEM, because as a teacher, I understand, or even as a person, not everybody wants to do the same thing.
Right.
Not everybody wants to build a robot.
Right.
Not everybody wants to code. Not everybody wants to design. You may have some kids that want to do cosmetic and make cosmetic items. That's a billion-dollar industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so from there, it kind of metamorphed into Seek being known as creating and doing diverse activities to give kids an idea on how they may want to transition into a different career. It may not be robotics, or it may be robotics. It may be drones. It may be building skateboards. It may be building mobile AC units. It may be making candles and learning about heat transfer, making lotion and learning about viscosity. So these are all different topics that we have done and created curriculum for students. So that was my experience as a educator, teaching science. And again, I went to school to teach kids with learning disabilities, but the good Lord said, I need you to be somewhere else. And I started with the science in sixth grade, and then with the nonprofit, was working at Breakthrough Miami, working with a cohort of, I think it was about maybe 12 or 15 girls.
Wow. We're talking with Anike Sikariyawo. Did I say
it
right?
You got it.
See, I got it.
You did.
This was just so wild. I'm able to pronounce the first part of your last name so easily because the Kari, right? Here in Dallas, we are so proud of our Olympian, Sha'Carri Richardson. So you know what I'm saying? It's like the first part of your last name is like her first name. And so anyway, I kind of like, even though you don't look anything like her, I just be envisioning somebody who accomplishes something or has a goal. And that's the way Sha'Carri was when she was running in the Olympics in Paris and whatnot. So I was like envisioning, oh yeah, I like it when somebody has a drive and they're going for it and the whole nine yards. So I got to take it back to, you know, your program. Like I said, it's a mobile nonprofit. Okay. And it's online. Can you talk about why you chose to do it that way as opposed to a brick and mortar? And I think it's almost brilliant because that's the way the world is going.
Yes. Yeah, so we were actually like, I won't say fours, but when the pandemic happened, we were like trying to figure it out like everyone else. So we were like reacting like, oh, we need to do something for kids. So we created our online program so that students will have access. And also with our STEM kits, which we are revamping our whole program for 2025. And that's how that metamorph. So the online program, we usually either deliver or mail out kits so that it can be aligned with the content that's being provided.
Mm-hmm.
And we usually try to have the kids to come together in a cohort in their area where we try to plan it out so that they can meet it. This was after post-pandemic, of course. And so now we're in the process of revamping our whole online program so that kids will have access to digital downloads and AI, because we're using a lot of AI software.
Exciting times. I mean, this is absolutely amazing. It's like it's fitting into what you're trying to do in the first place. So with that being said, let's talk about the holidays again and the fact that you're doing things around holiday themes. I'm grinning because I remember when, you know, once upon a time, people used to mail out these greeting cards. I mean, you used to mail them out, and every Christmas they put these greeting cards up on the fireplace, or they put them up on the kitchen table or something, or on the refrigerator with the magnets, and you'd see the, you know, Santa Claus or whatever it is, and it'd be from whatever family. And then I started noticing more people were doing these emails where they would email a Christmas card or a greeting card that would open up, and that industry was taking off. And I was like, okay, it's evolving. So on the holiday season right here, can you talk about some of the things that you've noticed that's evolving, and then what you guys are doing that's kind of like making it fun for the kids or fun for the family to take advantage of, you know, this is the way a lot of people are celebrating the holidays.
Yes. Yeah, so I would definitely say for us, we just recently had a shopping spree with our students.
Oh, nice.
With the parents as well. It was one of our partners, again, building relationships.
Mm-hmm.
One of our partners reached out to us, and we normally will have like just a holiday theme throughout the week for the students, where the parent come and we do a holiday giveaway. So that's what we've done for years, depending on the story that's submitted, you know, it may range from $500 to $2,000 that we will give the family for the holiday season. But we changed that because we had the shopping spree with family members that were with us, and the activities definitely shift from, you know, like you said, mailing out the picture with you and your dog, Merry Christmas, or the family card. And so we had our students to create their own holiday picture using pocket printers, just so that they can have something tangible, and it's just not 1000% AI.
Yeah.
So we did have our students use AI to create their own photo, and then they're going to mail it out or give it to whoever they want. They don't necessarily have to mail it, but we told them we want them to email it, but they, what is email? I'm like, you know, but this is for the baby. So I understand why they would ask that. But for the most part, our staff, in the past, we would have our pretty sweater event. So we transitioned that
from the ugly sweater to the pretty sweater. I'm following you. Yeah.
The thing is, they have to create their own sweater. Now that you have technology, you can make your sweaters. We have kids making their t-shirts for the holidays. So it's different activities that can definitely be done using artificial intelligence, and also creating activities where you can make gifts for other people. So the next event we have coming up is in Atlanta this Saturday and here in Miami, where the students will be making the water signs for candles, because in the past they made candles, but this time they're going to use AI to create, use AI generation to create their design and then put the watermark sign on the candles and then put it in a box and gift it to somebody. So there's a lot of things that can happen.
That is absolutely fantastic. And again, it's all about being creative and thinking. Can you talk about how STEM is either different or there's similarities to those who like gaming? Because a lot of kids are just all into gaming, and I didn't know if there is a way that you could utilize gaming to translate to how they can do some STEM projects at all, or is it two different things when it comes to your nonprofit?
So when it comes to gaming, because we definitely had gaming in the summer, there's so much that can happen with gaming. Like, it has its pros and its cons like anything else. But in regards to STEM, it teaches kids like algorithm on how they can use a specific process to get to the goal.
Oh, okay.
So understanding that, exactly. Like, some of them, they have to dance.
Right.
They love the Roblox. But it's a strategic process, steps and procedures that they must do in order to get to the next phase. So a lot of times we utilize that process and teaching students that it's strategic thinking, it's logical thinking, and we apply the STEM aspect of, okay, now we're going to have you to create your own video game, because we've done that topic in the past with students online, where you're going to create your own game. You have to come up with your process, your name, your logo on how the game is going to look, who are the audience, or who do you want to target, your demographics. So there's so many bits and pieces that you can incorporate with gaming when it comes to students, well, children in general. But just not, you know, not just letting them have free play, because a lot of times you have parents or, you know, or they just do the free play, but understanding the STEM behind it, even the math part of it. So there's definitely a lot of pieces when it comes to gaming and the innovation. So I would highly encourage parents who have students, well, children, I keep saying students because, you know, I don't have kids, so I just keep saying.
And you're used to being an educator. Yep.
Yeah. So parents with their children, just encourage them, let them create their own gaming system, because there are so many apps that can be used. I mean, apps, artificial intelligence that you can use to create gaming. Julius AI, that's a AI tool that can give the child the coding to use to create their own gaming system.
Wow.
So parents can literally work with their child and have them to draw out the plans, what their gaming company name would be, use an AI tool to generate it, and then they can eventually do an LLC and create their own gaming.
And Nikkei, she is the educator and CEO, the founder of Seek Education. That's Seeking Education Empowers Knowledge, the foundation. And I want to know how your nonprofit kind of is spreading across the country. Because, you know, sometimes people are just centrally located in one city or one small town, but you're able to, you know, make your organization grow a little bit across, you know, states and whatnot. Can you talk about that particular journey?
Yes. For myself, I said, I'm always traveling to Atlanta. Mm-hmm. I used to have a place there and I was like, how can I, you know, start something here and expand the program. So it just started with me thinking, you know what, I can host a Saturday, start on Saturdays, do the legal paperwork that needs to happen and host a Saturday and then partner, because, you know, people, they don't know you. They don't know Anike. Really? They know, mm-hmm. maybe, you know, a percent of people know Anike. Mm-hmm. And so working with partners and showcasing the work that we have done somewhere else and telling partners, this is what we can do for you if we partner together, because the goal is for us to partner and provide the same services to impact children, families, parents. And so doing that, I always go and say, this is what we can offer, but this is what we would need from you. And so we've been blessed to partner with, like, let's say Atlanta, since that's the first one we started with. Mm-hmm. Okay, we can offer this program because it's funded, but you will have to donate the space for free. And then from there, we'll look for a program manager, but it's all about us partnering. And then also myself, like, I know teacher friends all over, not saying I know a lot of people, but we're partnering with a school in California starting mm-hmm. next year. Mm-hmm. And it's based on a person who went to school with me, who was an educator. And then 20 years later, we're open legally in California, but now we're going to be working with a school there. So it's all about the relationships exactly. built and then strategically mm-hmm. looking at your budget, of course. Like, we have this funding, but we would need you to donate the space so that we can operate out of the space and then, you know, eventually find a person to operate and manage it in that particular area or neighborhood.
What they call it nowadays is networking, is the relationships, because that helps sometimes mm-hmm. make things happen when you have, you know, like-minded ideas. And I really believe the things that you're doing are so significant. We're talking about, of course, science, technology, engineering, math, throwing the arts, and so she got STEM and STEAM. And mm-hmm. that's what the programs are all about, especially for kids ages 3 through 18. Is there a place where people can find out more information, where they can either partner with you, volunteer with you, or have their families start taking some courses or being involved with the nonprofit?
Absolutely. You can always contact us at 1-888-346-5552. And if you want to directly speak with me, it is extension number 6. You can go to our website, which is www.seekedu.org. And you can also follow us on social media. We are on Instagram with our, our at symbol, which is Seek, SEEK INC. Again, Instagram is SEEK INC. And we are also on Twitter, which is Seek_INC. We are on Facebook. If you just type in Seek Foundation, you will find us. And if you type in Seek Foundation, you will also find us on LinkedIn. And we have a YouTube channel with activities that you can do at home with your kids and some of the things that we have done with our students. And in Miami, we're located at different locations, but we are building our first smart tech health hub that will be completed in 2 years based on a multi-million-dollar grant that we received this year. So that's all the information I have about Seek Foundation. And I pray that you all reach out to us, and we will be in Texas. We're still working out the logistics, but that information will go out sometime in January.
Excellent. Seek Foundation. Anike, we've got to do this again and again.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to hearing from you, and a great success, especially through the holidays and going into next year. You take care, and thanks again.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Our next guest is Carla Harvey. She is a grief coach, an end-of-life doula, and a thanatologist with over a decade of experience in funeral services, hospice care, and coaching. And I thought it was really important to have you on the show this time of the year, because it is the holidays And a lot of people are emotional on various extremes during the holidays. Some people can be very, very happy and glad to be with family or friends. And then there are others who may have lost someone recently, and they're trying to figure out the best ways to cope. Carla, how are you doing this today?
I'm doing good. It's a little gloomy. You know, we've got that I'm in the Midwest here, and we got the Midwest gloom just kind of spreading in, which can also be a little bit debilitating during this time, you know. So everyone should be taking their vitamin D and trying to keep a smile on their faces as best they can, right?
Exactly. And I'm enjoying talking to you because how people handle grief and adversity and things of that nature, sometimes you just need to have someone you can either listen to or someone who can listen to you. Can you talk about some of the insights and coping strategies that you've had to share with people over the years? Because you've been doing this for a little while.
Yeah, I've been doing it for a really long time. And, you know, I started off as a mortician many, many years ago.
Really?
I was a mortician in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And I had also been in entertainment. I actually left entertainment to be a funeral director full time. And it was just life changing. And I also worked in hospice at the time.
Let's talk about that just for a second, because it's so interesting. How in the world you transition from entertainment to mortician? I mean, it seems like those are almost opposites, but then again, I'm just wondering what drew you to that particular career change.
You know, it may seem like complete opposites, but I'll tell you the one thing they have in common is connection with people. You know, I was always fascinated with death and dying since I was a kid, not necessarily in a morbid way, but more of a kind of fascination with everything behind it. Mm-hmm. What happens to our bodies? What happens after we die, how to handle all the emotions that go along with it. And so fast forward, you know, I'm in Los Angeles, I live in my life. I was a news reporter, I was playing in bands, and I just felt like I was missing out on something. I wanted to connect with people on a deeper level. I found a school that offered a mortuary science program. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, I wish someone had told me about this when I was in high school. I didn't know that you could actually go to school to be a mortician. I thought it was this career that you had to be kind of born into. You
know, yeah, families or something. The family business or something.
That's how you got into it. So I just never knew. So it was incredible for me to kind of swap my one life that was very exciting and fast paced to go into full-time program that is intense. You know, you've got anatomy, physiology, restorative arts, pathology classes, embalming 101 at 8 o'clock in the morning. So it changed my life, but in such a big, beautiful, broad way. And then when I got into the funeral homes and I was working with families, it was just, man, to be able to hold space for someone when they need it the most is just a gift. And I feel that people who choose funeral service or anything with grief work, we're called to it in a way because we can hold that space, whereas others may not be able to. And so it's a gift to be able to do it for people. So many years later, here I am, I'm still in death care. You know, I work with a company called Parting Stone that is changing the grieving process for families, transforming grief by offering a new form of remains in the form of stones rather than cremated remains.
I saw that. Yeah, that's interesting.
Also, yeah, it's incredible. We'll get to that, I'm sure. But I'm also a grief coach and, you know, a thanatologist. I'm, you know, well-versed in death, dying, and bereavement. And just, like I said, holding space for people has been just a big, big gift in my life.
What it is it shows that you're empathetic and you decided, you know what, I can share this and actually help people through some of their processes. But you are empathetic from the beginning because you're curious and you just wondered why some of these things were happening. Am I wrong?
Oh, for sure. And then I really, about 10 years ago, I started my grief coaching company because I was in a band and I noticed that the fans, they wanted to talk about the music, of course, but they were so interested in my background as a mortician, and they wanted to know how they could, you know, get help with an issue they were going through, whether it was a loss that was because of a divorce or a life change or a death that had occurred. They wanted to know what they could do to feel better. And I had this light bulb moment and I was like, man, someone needs to be talking about this more. Someone needs to be helping, especially disenfranchised people with their grief work. Someone needs to help facilitate it. So that's how I came into, you know, really putting everything into this career.
Well, you know, I really enjoy your explaining all of these things because a lot of people are kind of curious about how you would become like a grief coach or these things like that. And I can just tell by the sound of your voice, you have a very comforting voice. And so I can just imagine, you know, you're being with people and talking them through or listening to them while they deal with whatever grief or pain they're dealing with. And like I said, these are the holidays. And a lot of people are basically having holidays for the first time without a particular loved one. Are there any tips on navigating first holidays without someone that you really care about?
Yeah. So, you know, from the time that we're kids, it's ingrained in us that the holidays are the time to spend with loved ones. Mm-hmm. And you know, you've got all these memories of the season that are warm and fuzzy, and they're full of food and stockings and opening your stockings on Christmas morning and laughter and gifts. So when you've experienced a loss and you have to think about doing these things without the person that you loved, it feels profoundly challenging. And even if some time has passed since the loss and you feel like things are getting better, the holidays can kind of trigger those emotions because of all of the memories and traditions that you shared with your person. And not only that, but there's so much hustle and bustle during the holidays and everyone seems so cheery. And there's this societal pressure to have a perfect holiday. And honestly, when we're grieving, we feel like we shouldn't be happy. We shouldn't be experiencing, you know, happy feelings or joy, because we almost feel sometimes a little guilty, like it takes away from the loss. Mm-hmm. But I do want to stress to everyone out there that your emotions are completely valid and there is a space where joy can coexist with grief during this time. But let's talk about some ways that you can start to cope.
Yeah. And by the way, let me co-sign on that because, you know, in the New Orleans area, we're here in Texas, but in the New Orleans area, it's a going home party. It's almost like a celebration of that person's life. So that kind of helps it. And it's not as sad. So as you said, people deal with grief in different ways. And if you're not totally sad, it's okay, because you're probably thinking about them in the wonderful ways that you knew that person.
Yeah. And yes, it's very different, you know, culture to culture, gender to gender. It can be different, you know, the way that we perceive things. So that's really important to remember, too, when supporting friends. Everyone's grief experience is different. There's no right or wrong way. You shouldn't have to feel pressured, even if you're part of a culture that has these going home celebrations and you don't really feel that way. It's okay to feel different than the person next to you. That's okay. I think that the first step, you know, is determining what's going to feel meaningful and supportive for you during the holiday. And you can kind of ask yourself, what's going to be helpful or comforting for me? It's okay to be a little selfish and ask, you know, what's it going to be for me? You know, and that could be just driving around and looking at Christmas lights with a playlist of your person's favorite music. It could be making sure your kids, you know, have all their gifts in order. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes it's okay to scale back and just wait until the next year to engage with holiday traditions. If it's too much for you, it's okay to take a time out of the holidays this year, and you shouldn't feel bad about that. But I will say this, that sometimes the anticipation of the holidays is actually worse than the day itself.
You know, you're saying something there, because sometimes people let it build up.
Yeah, we all do that. We let it build up, and we don't say anything sometimes. And sometimes it helps to, along the way, kind of say, hey, I'm feeling a little overwhelmed by all of this holiday stuff. And even admitting to yourself that, man, I went to the stores today and holiday music's playing and I got angry because my person's not here. Just kind of taking the time out each day to acknowledge your feelings, that can be really, really helpful to not feel so isolated. I feel like when you're in the thick of it, sometimes, you know, taking out a piece of paper and a pencil throughout the day and just doing a brief little journal and saying, you know, what happened during the day and what about it? Whether it's a great moment, like, you know, you had your first peppermint latte and it reminded you of having coffee with your person. And maybe you shed a couple tears, but at the same time you were happy because you thought about that person. You had a good memory of drinking a peppermint latte with them. Or like I said, you walk in and you see all the holiday decorations and you have an overwhelming sense of grief and you're angry. Go home and write about that too. Something about connecting, you know, a pen and pencil to paper and getting out those feelings can be so healing. I still do it today for myself all the time.
This is really, really good stuff. And I can't say this enough, Carla. You've got a very soothing voice. It's like,
thank you.
I mean, the words you're saying is like, oh yeah, you're right. I can just imagine everybody listening, just nodding along. And again, she is Carla Harvey. She is a grief coach, a grief specialist. She's also, she's got a diverse background with all, like I said, a mortician. She's a partner in the success manager at Parting Stone. We're going to get into that company as well, because I love the way that particular opportunity presented itself for you. And it's all about, you know, people and how they can still share things with the ones that they loved, even though they may be gone. But before we go into that, I got two different situations, two scenarios. And I want you to share with people how they might navigate the grief through the holidays on these two different types of scenarios. Okay, sure. A couple of months ago, my 102-year-old grandmother passed away. And it was actually a really wonderful occasion because she was not sick. It was just her time. And I think our whole family was like, we all came together. We were sad that the granny was gone, but it was like, okay, she's up in heaven and now she's looking down upon us. So is there a way you can honor loved ones during, you know, the holidays, you know, with the family traditions? Because we used to just go to granny's house for the holidays.
Yeah.
And then the second one, and again, take your time on both of these.
Sure.
I also lost a friend and coworker a couple of weeks later, a couple of months ago. And, you know, when you're talking about friends and family and supporting like his family that's still around, how are ways that you can make sure that you're not like overwhelming them, but letting them know, I'm talking about his family, that you still care or that you hadn't forgotten about him? Because we know that his family still cares and he's definitely not forgotten.
Yes. Yes. Well, let's start with the first aspect there. You know, say you lose someone like your grandma, mm-hmm. and I just lost my uncle this year. So we're going to celebrate our first holiday without him. And it's extremely, you know, sad and not to have that person around that you've got so many traditions with.
Right.
But, you know, you may have heard the term new normal during a grief journey. And that term means adjusting to life without your loved one, but incorporating the pain of grief while still finding ways to move forward. So during the holidays, we got to find a way to move forward. So there's lots of things you can do during the holiday season to honor a loved one. One thing that I love is really easy, and that's food traditions. You can, you know, if they had a favorite holiday dish, if your granny, she loved this one casserole. Every year we make funeral potatoes, and I didn't know they were called funeral potatoes until I was older. And I thought that's so fitting, but it's this special dish. So now those aren't funeral potatoes. Those are granny's potatoes next time you make them.
Yeah.
And also like having a recipe that's been written down throughout, you know, many years, it's great to get a copy of that for everybody that's coming over for Christmas or for a holiday.
Oh yeah, the recipe. Yeah, there you go.
Make dish. It's just something like, for instance, my fiance, his mother passed away before I ever met him or knew him. But let me tell you, I know this woman because I eat her famous Thanksgiving stuffing, mm-hmm. this Italian stuffing. I've been eating it since I've known, you know, my future husband. So I feel like I understand a part of this person, even though I never met her. So it's a great way to continue a tradition throughout generations and really, you know, have that just carry on for a long period of time, which I absolutely love. So food, 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 and get, you know, make a copy of those recipes for everyone. You can make a little booklet or just do a couple favorite ones. But I think it's really important for people. Music playlists. Music is a huge part of my life. So, you know,
the bands.
If your person that you lost was always in control of the holiday playlist, you know, kind of have that be an ode to him or mm-hmm. her, you know, include their favorite songs mm-hmm. and on the tradition to someone else in the family, that is now going to curate that music playlist. I love the idea of leaving out an extra place setting for someone that you've lost. And it's a symbolic gesture. And it just lets some people know that, you know, even though Granny's not here anymore, we are going to honor her and we are going to celebrate her. And she's still here with us. Another thing that I really, really love is memory sharing. You can put a stocking out and have a little post-it note station with some pens next to it. And everyone can put a memory of the person that they're missing in the stocking and read them together over dessert. I absolutely love that.
Oh, yeah.
The other thing I recommend is not hesitating to use the person's name. Yes, it's sad that they're not there, but you know, it's also awesome to say, man, Granny would have been singing and drinking her hot toddy right now.
Yeah.
It can make people feel comfortable sharing mm-hmm. their memories. The other thing that I love to do is, you know, say that someone in the family does something that Granny used to always do, just genetics, you know?
Yeah.
Point it out, say, man, you smile just like your grandma used to.
Mm-hmm.
The way you said that was just like grandma used to say it. That makes these memories happy. It makes everyone feel like they're, you know, part of it. And it's a great way to, again, initiate conversation. And as far as, you know, how to be supportive to another family, you mentioned that you had a friend die, and I'm so sorry for both of your losses, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
It's sometimes easier when someone's had what we call a good death. They've lived a long, full life. And then you've got someone who, in contrast,
that was a surprise.
And it's a surprise. Yeah. And that's hard to deal with. And it's hard to understand how to support that person's family. But what I can say is they do want support. They may not ask you for support. They may not know how to tell you what they need, and that's okay. Grieving people aren't always going to be able to say, hey, it would really support me right now if you could drop off, you know, a casserole so I could feed my family while I'm in the midst of grief. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we have to do things on our own agenda. You know, we have to just make that casserole, leave it on the front porch. We have to make the calls. We have to say, hey, can I come over and maybe clean up your kitchen for you? What can I do to be helpful to you right now? You don't have to avoid talking about the death. They're aware that it's happened. I think that we're afraid of not having the right words.
That's it. That's a lot of people. They don't know what to say.
Yeah. And that's okay to not know what to say. You can even say to the person, I don't know what to say right now, but I want you to know that I'm here and I love you and I support you. And if I could just, you know, sit with you here, I just want you to know that I'm in this space with you. And sometimes that's all that's needed. Words aren't needed. I think there's some things that aren't helpful. I think that one thing that isn't helpful at all is saying they're in a better place. Or, you know, God wanted an angel back. And I'll tell you why those are not good things to say. And I know that people say them with good intentions. But as far as making a statement very religious, not everyone shares the same sentiments religiously. And even if they do, it's not a better place for them, or they're not, they still
right.
want their
the family and friend, they still want them down here. They still want them right here in the workplace or right here down the street.
Exactly. So be mindful of saying things that you think are helpful, but may not be helpful. Again, so that's with they're in a better place, or, they're not suffering anymore, or they're, God wanted their angel back. They're the easy things to say, but I'll tell you this, it's much nicer just to say, I'm here for you. I support you.
Yeah.
It just comes off a little bit better.
I totally agree. And we're talking with Carla Harvey. Like I said, she's a grief coach, end of life doula, a thanatologist. Am I saying that right?
Thanatologist. Yes, I'm a certified thanatologist specializing in death, dying, and bereavement.
Yes, and funeral services, hospice care, coaching. And you also mentioned, like I said, you're a partner with the Success Manager. Partner and success manager at Parting Stone. I'm interested in this company because, like a lot of people who've lost someone in their family or friends, you have people who are buried, you have people who have headstones, you have people who are cremated. In fact, my father-in-law was cremated, and he was a former Marine, and he's like his part of his ashes are in a wall, for the service his country, and then part of them are with my mother-in-law. And this Parting Stone company, it's an interesting idea, and I think it makes a lot of sense for a lot of people. Can you talk about what you guys do as an alternate to ashes with the cremation process?
Sure. So cremation is on the rise, and it grows every year. I think over 60% of people now are choosing cremation rather than, burial, for a number of reasons. Not just because of the cost. It is generally a lower cost, but there's so many great reasons to choose cremation. And, obviously one of the big things is that we are, we move around more than ever. We don't stay in our hometown so much anymore. Families are separated.
You are making a huge point because people, they don't stay in the same town or city all of their lives.
No,
anymore.
So the family plot is a thing of the past, So people are choosing cremation, but there's still kind of something amiss about the process. And it's the ashes. Ashes or cremated remains are messy. They're hard to scatter. You've seen horror stories I was watching the Real Housewives show. Don't judge me. I love the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
But one of the ladies was taking her mentor's ashes to Europe to spread, and she, tosses them out, and they blow back in all the women's faces and get in their fancy
places
and stick in their lip gloss. And, typically ashes are hard to scatter. They're hard to share with people. Mm-hmm. Typically they stay in one person's home. You don't know where to put them all the time. You feel guilty if you don't want to display them on the mantle, but you also feel weird about having them out in case people come over. So what Parting Stone has done is that we've created a new form of remains. So instead of getting back the cremated remains in, the ash form. And I say ashes, they're not really ashes. What they are is bone fragments, but most people relate to the word ash. But instead of getting them back in ash form, the family gets back a collection of stones. And it's really transforming the grief process for families, because now they have a collection of 40 to 80 stones that they can hold. They can share it with friends. Imagine everyone coming over for Christmas and being able to hand out one of Granny's stones to everybody. And you get to have a piece of this beautiful human with you at all times. Someone you can talk to, you can put it in your pocket if you're having a hard day, if you've got a hard doctor's appointment to go to or a speech to give somewhere. You can put one of these stones in your pocket and just have that little support of the person that you loved with you. And if you want to scatter the remains, you could take these all over the world with you and put them in your person's favorite spots and places. I've got a gentleman in Tennessee whose wife died, and anytime that one of his friends goes somewhere beautiful, he has them take one of his wife's stones with them. And now she's been to the Eiffel Tower. She's got a stone at Loch Ness.
Wow.
You know, and it's just for his grieving process, mm-hmm. knowing that his wife has gone to all these places. It's just helped him tremendously. So just being able to hold these stones, interact with them, spread them in a, you know, a more, in a beautiful way. It's just so healing for the family.
Well, let me tell you, Carla, you are an excellent person talking about grief. Parting Stone, is it partingstone.com where people can find out more information?
Yeah. Check out partingstone.com. We've got a wealth of information on our site. It's a beautiful site and showcases a variety of the stones and family letters, so you can kind of see for yourself how wonderful it is.
Well, let me tell you something. It's been a wonderful conversation we're having with you, because you've touched on so many things, especially this time of the year when people are dealing with the holidays and maybe some possible grief. Carla Harvey, thank you for joining us. We got to get you on real soon.
Yeah, thank you so much. Talk to you soon.
Thank you all for joining us on Better Living, a show about people or organizations having a big impact in North Texas. I'm your host, Chris Arnold. So long, everybody.